Monin, you all right? Are you? I hope so. Me, yeah, I'm all right. Same old, same old. It has just ticked past 8 in the a.m. British summer time on Friday, the 10th of April in the year of our Lord 2026 now. You are the glorious band, the chosen few, of course. You know who you are. Come on, come on. Well, you're not going to watch Mike Graham or Jeremy Kyle in the Bo Show. Breakfast with Bo. Come on, let's get real. I'm joined by my producer, Little Harry, like every morning. How are you this morning, sir? Good, good. You might have noticed I'm sitting in a different seat. What's that all about? Well, I'm joined by a guest. I'm only bloody joined by a guest. Charlie Downs of Reform, of Restore fame.
There we go.
How are you this morning?
I am very well. What a pleasure it is to hear those iconic words in person. I'm a regular listener, so it's very good to be here.
There you go. Lovely. Lovely jubbly. Yeah, no, appreciate it. Thanks for coming in. Thanks for coming in so early.
Yeah.
Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Yeah. No, very much so. Yeah.
Rocking and raring to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful morning. Good to
it
be
is.
Out.
It is.
You know? Yeah.
It's crisp, but nice, yeah. Isn't it? It's crisp, but it's nice. It's nice. You can feel spring, summer.
Yeah.
Summer's not too far away, hopefully. Mm. Although they said we're going to have another cold snap.
Mm. Well, it's pretty chilly. I mean, public transport was completely empty this morning, which is always nice. Enjoyable.
Nice. And you're coming from the east.
Yes.
So everyone's going the other way to you.
Yeah.
So nice. Yeah.
No, it's a good morning to be here.
All right. Should we jump straight into it? We'll just do the front pages. What's the corporate mainstream media banging on about this morning? All right. We've got a bit about Melania Trump. Mm.
It's all very weird, this. I watched the video this morning.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And I thought the whole thing was bizarre.
It's a little bit odd. Mm. We'll get into it if anyone doesn't know. If anyone has been watching the news in the last, 12 hours or less, we'll get into it. The First Lady made a statement. It's not all that common, is it? Mm. Particularly for Melania.
Yeah.
But okay, so...
Without the president's knowledge as well, if rumours are to be believed.
That's, for me, that's the oddest element of the whole thing. That's proper weird to me. But okay, so we've got, I'm not Epstein's victim, says Melania. And we see you, Vlad. That's Vladimir Putin, not Vlad the Impaler. So, yes, a little bit of Russia, a little bit of Melania, and, of course, more Iran stuff, and a little bit of Britain falling to pieces in front of our very eyes.
The usual.
Yeah, de rigueur. The standard stuff. How can you not notice?
Yeah.
It's impossible not to notice anymore, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so let's jump straight into it then. The Times, the venerable Times. Oh, the Rolling Stones are going to keep... Oh, how are they still alive?
I know.
And I don't mean that in a nasty, horrible way, but...
Yeah.
How is Keith Richards not dead yet?
I know.
I mean that in the least horrible way possible.
Yeah. I saw that, and I just thought, like, it's literally just like the boomer paradigm forever. It's never going to end.
They will never end, yeah. Like, Keith Richards will live to be 200 years old or something.
He'll put his brain into a computer, and that'll be in concerts and 1,000 years' time.
A head in a jar, like in Futurama.
Yeah.
Just forever. Okay. With world's eyes on Middle East... Russian subs tried to spy on UK. So I think I will leave that in a little bit when we'll talk about it in detail when it's the main focus of a front page, and it will be, it is. But the Ruskies, if you believe how the papers characterise it, are getting a bit more belligerent in the North Sea, but we'll talk about it in a bit. So should we start with Melania then? Mm. So if anyone doesn't know, that's Trump's... Slovenian or Slovakian?
Slovenian, I think.
Slovenian wife. Yeah. I mean, she's a handsome lady, isn't she? She was a model, wasn't she?
Yeah.
She was a model, so... she rarely speaks. Mm. Rarely speaks at all. Which is actually more the norm. So, first ladies, or even just first partners... Mm. Like, for example, I'm thinking of maybe Maggie Thatcher obviously had a husband, Dennis Thatcher, right? Old Dennis Thatcher. Mm. It's hard not to like Dennis Thatcher, I thought. Mm. Obviously, lefties despised him, but most other people thought he was sort of quite charismatic and funny. Mm. But he kept his mouth shut most of the time, as first ladies usually do. But not all of them. So, for an example, well, obviously, Hillary Clinton.
For our sins.
Yeah. Wouldn't shut up and insisted in having a political career of her own, didn't she? I mean, she's a senator and everything. Well, she was in Obama's government, for God's sake. She was Secretary of State.
Ran for president.
Well, of course, yeah. Failed. But she was Secretary of State, wasn't she, in the end? But Michelle Obama, Big Mike, likes to chip in. She always likes to chip in. But mostly they don't, right? Mostly it's actually really, it's your job to be quiet.
Yeah.
It's your job not to overshadow the leader,
yes,
the one with actual office, a lot. So for one of the greatest examples I always think of, I think I've talked about it before on the podcast and stuff, is Jackie Kennedy.
Mm.
Right, Jackie Kennedy was, in a way, sort of the archetypal perfect first lady in a number of ways. But she very, very deliberately, even if, from time to time, a reporter would ask her, what do you think about something or other? What do you think about Khrushchev? What do you think about Cuba? You know, and she would say, I'm not, it's got nothing to do with me.
Mm.
That's Jack's domain. Don't ask me.
Yes.
You can ask me about, she wouldn't say it in that tone.
Mm.
She's very polite. She's like, ask me about like the decoration in the White House or what dress I'm wearing.
Yes.
Don't ask me about policy.
Mm.
So, okay, Melania's much more just like that. She's just, she's his wife and that's it.
Yes. And I've got to say, knowing people who have partners, men or women, who work in the political field, when both parties in a relationship are politicians,
mm,
generally the relationship is not particularly healthy. So I think for world leaders, it's actually quite important that they have a Jackie Kennedy at their side, because that means that they're not working 24/7,
right,
if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
it means,
yeah,
that when,
yeah,
when the door shuts at the end of the day, they're a husband, they're a father, you know, they're not continuing to be a politician. But when you have a kind of, I imagine like a, you know, Frank and Claire Underwood type,
yeah,
relationship, which I imagine what that's what the Clinton household is like.
Or Mr. and Mrs. Balls.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Can you imagine, yeah, what, well, I don't really want to imagine, but
yeah,
what their, because obviously his career was much more high profile than hers first.
Mm.
And now he's just a TV anchor.
Yeah.
And she's
foreign, well, sex.
She's the foreign sex. So, yeah. I mean,
yeah,
I imagine Ed Balls is comfortable enough in his own skin and his own career not to it to be a problem, but still,
yes,
she comes home and she's the power in the, out of the couple. Mm. Now I would imagine that it would be best nearly always, if whoever it is, man or woman, but it's nearly always going to be the man, isn't it, that they want a spouse that's there to not get headlines, to very, yeah, proactively not be in the headlines.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they usually do, you know, like Sam Cam, mm, or something.
Mm.
Just, it's basically your job not to cause any ripples ever.
Yeah.
So, and that's, and Melania's good at that, right? She has been always, I think, pretty damn good.
And I think she's reasonably popular as well among the general American public. I mean, I don't have the polling to hand, but I remember reading years back that she was very well regarded by a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing to dislike, unless you're like a hater, unless you want to make out that Michelle Obama is really, really pretty and Melania Trump isn't.
Mm.
They do try to do that. I've seen that.
Childish.
It's like, it's insane. Obviously, Melania is so much more attractive than Michelle Obama, obviously.
Mm.
But anyway, all right. So, she just stays quiet through everything, even all Trump's like allegations of like sexual misconduct and stuff. She just keeps shtum. But then, now, she came out, like last night, would it be,
mm,
and did a little four, five, 6 minutes to camera in the White House.
Yeah.
And she said,
prepared statement.
Yeah, reading a prepared statement. Because the First Lady will have a team around her,
mm,
a whole team of like publicists and PR people and political advisor and all sorts, largely to make sure nothing, there's no ripples.
Mm.
But so she came out and she said, well, she basically said, I'm not Epstein's victim.
Mm.
There's loads of pictures out there of me with Epstein. They're all fake. I sent one email to him once, just to sort of as a thank you type one-liner almost. I don't know if it was a one-liner, but I sent one email to him once, just
to find out, casual conversation,
out of politeness.
Yeah.
Just a polite reply sort of thing. The only times I ever met him was in public at parties,
yeah,
with Trump.
Yeah.
Never went to his island, never saw any wrongdoing or criminality,
mm,
just complete denial of everything. And I absolutely was never in a relationship with him. It's been alleged that it has been,
mm,
and all that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what do you think about that? She's obviously, it feels like she's trying to get ahead of something.
Yes.
But she's not like it's been in the news for a day or a week that,
yeah,
all those allegations, front pages and stuff, and now she's responding to it.
Mm.
It seems to have come almost out of nowhere.
Well, it is certainly noteworthy given the wider geopolitical context that she's choosing now to make this intervention at a time where, I mean, obviously there's now no ceasefire, but that did, you know, that was kind of the headline the last couple of days. And so as that collapses, she chooses that moment to come out and say, by the way, guys, I have nothing to do with Epstein. Like, it's like, why now? And I thought there were a number of things that she said during her address, which were just very, like, they spoke to, as you said, knowledge of something more, something wider. And there was actually one line that I perceived as a threat, right? A veiled threat. She said, words to the effect of, male executives who resigned when the matter, Epstein, became politicized should be investigated. And I thought that is obviously a very pointed kind of, you know, I think that's about a specific individual or perhaps a specific group of individuals, which I read that to be a threat. So obviously, I mean, one interpretation of this is the Trump family has been threatened by, you know, nefarious forces who perhaps have their hands on Epstein materials that could be used to discredit or damage the reputation of the Trump family. And Melania is therefore coming out and saying, you know, we've got dirt on you too, in effect.
Maybe, yeah. It does feel like she's getting out ahead of something.
I did think she looked shaken as well. Wait, maybe
she wasn't happy about it, was she?
Yeah, maybe it's because she's not used to being, you know, in the limelight and actually being the one speaking. But I thought she came across as being quite nervous.
Yeah, I mean, you would be. Unless it's your job 24/7 to speak, you probably would be, wouldn't it? It's sort of one of the biggest moments of her life in a way. Yeah. Like millions of eyeballs just on her voice.
Yes.
Imagine. If that's not your bread and butter, it would be nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
So that happened. I did see one report this morning on some news. And they bandied about around Candace Owens. Okay. That it might be so, if not Candace Owens herself, people like Candace Owens who do a little bit more sort of, and this is not a pop at Candace Owens particularly, but just might engage a bit more in more rumour stuff.
Yeah, sure.
And that people like that level of commentator might well have talked about Melania and Epstein a bit, a little bit.
Yeah.
And that she's just, even that is like a so annoying to Melania personally that she's dying to make a statement. But as we said a moment ago, the thing that I find about all of that happened, and it's like, okay, like not really a big deal ultimately. I'll take her at her word. I'm prepared to take her at her word. There's no reason particularly to disbelieve her. But what I thought was interesting was what the Mail goes with.
Yeah.
Look, Donald Trump makes astonishing claim he was blindsided by her wife Melania's Jeffrey Epstein bombshell. First Lady took to the White House podium to tell shocked world she was not a victim of perverted financier. And in this, it says, the president told MS Now he didn't know anything about the First Lady's statement before she appeared on camera. Mm. When I read that, I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fully into the realm of odd now for me.
Yes.
So she must have, and the team around her, deliberately not told him or his team then.
Or they didn't. And this is a strategy. And he's saying that
40 chest.
So that it can be seen as maybe, she's done this purely of her own volition and I didn't know anything about it, which I think maybe in their minds might give it more credibility.
Maybe. It's totally possible.
Yeah.
It's totally possible, isn't it?
Yeah.
I hadn't even really considered that. I just took that at face value.
Yeah.
It could be.
Yeah.
It could be.
Can't put anything past these people. I mean, you know, this
if
is the White
that
House.
Is just, yeah, right. Yeah. That it's their job to play a little bit of games,
yes,
isn't it? But if that is true, that he genuinely did not know anything about the fact she was about to make this statement, and the first time he was aware of it is when he sees it on the news. That would be, not that she embarrassed herself in any way or did anything wrong or dropped the ball or anything like that, but if I was Trump, I'd be annoyed by that. I'd be like, you didn't drop the ball and you haven't embarrassed us and ultimately it's not a problem, but didn't you want to run that by me, the president?
Yeah.
You're making a statement in the White House about things that do affect the government and me and policy a tiny bit. And do you want to run that by me, love?
Yeah, one of the most contentious issues of our time as well. You know, the mass trafficking of children by this, you know, potentially Mossad intelligence agent that every elite in the West is implicated in.
Yeah, I mean,
you want to run that by me first, love?
You say potentially. I think in the DOJ dump, it just explicitly, an FBI file just said he was trained by Ehud Barak in the Israeli intelligence services.
Yeah. It's obvious. Like,
there's a document that just says that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But this is the thing. I mean, if it is a strategy that they want to, that in fact Trump did know that this was going to happen, and he's saying that he didn't for some reason, it's a weird one because it makes them look completely disjointed.
Yeah, because so if it is the angle you said that they did know, yeah, you, they then open themselves up to the accusation of what's going on, guys. Yeah. Like Melania and Trump themselves and their teams aren't talking to each other. What's up with that?
Yeah.
Anyway, it's actually in the scheme of things, everything that's going on in the world right now, not a giant thing. Let's have a look at this.
There was, just very quickly, there was one other aspect of her statement which I thought was interesting, which was that she called for Congress to intervene Epstein issue and to hold a public hearing for survivors, which is, I think, that's a huge thing to ask for, because that obviously thus far has not happened. And at some point, as with the rape gangs in our country, at the bottom level, this is like a top level rape gang, if you want. At some point, it's all going to need to be brought out into the open. So for her to be the one to come out and say that that needs to happen in Congress is quite a big thing.
Yeah, yeah, right? It is. Yeah. And again, you would think Trump might be a bit like, you're stepping on my toes a little bit. That's, you're getting towards the fringes of actual like government policy here now. Didn't want to tell me you're going to say that, do that.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. It would be good, wouldn't it? I mean, they've got the Epstein Transparency Act. Mm. And, you know, certain elements within the US establishment are trying to get as much transparency as they can.
Yeah.
But it has been noted, hasn't it, that in the United States, fewer people than many of us might have liked being held to account. Yeah. Right? Still loads of people not really being held. Larry Summers. Not being, Sergey Brin, not being held to account for what they may or may not have done. We still don't know exactly what they may or may not have done.
Yeah.
So it was good of her to say that. I'm prepared to take her completely at her word, what she says about it. And while we're here, while we talk about Epstein, what is, like, Restore's policy on that? What's the thinking in the camp about dealing with it?
Well, look, I mean, it's a matter of public record that elites, governing officials at the highest level within the British establishment were directly implicated in the Epstein operation.
Obviously, more than just Mandy and Andy.
Yeah, well, namely Peter Mandelson, but various others as well.
And George Osborne. George Osborne.
Yeah, well, he was named, wasn't he?
Nathaniel Rothschild, the fifth Baron Rothschild.
Yeah, and Nick Candy of Reform UK fame. I think. Double check that. But look, I mean, our position is that it should all be, all of the details of any British officials in public life who were implicated in the Epstein operation in any capacity should be made public. You know, this should all be published. It should be made available for public consumption, because it's, you know, it's our right to know what our elected and unelected officials have been up to. And if they were involved with this guy, Epstein, and whatever it was he was actually doing, what does that mean for our politics and the way that our country has been governed for God knows how many years, decades, you know? So we would run a full inquiry into the Epstein operation, the extent to which British officials were implicated, and proceed from there.
Nice. So a full hangout.
Yeah. Because Rupert's not implicated. He's not in the files. He's got no skeletons in his closet.
Yeah.
So, you know, has to be done.
It's a classic family man, isn't it?
Yeah.
Roops.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great stuff. Wholesome. Yeah. Wholesome. Yeah. Go the full hangout route. Brilliant. What more can you ask for, really? Mm. What more can you ask for? Okay. A little bit about NATO here. US prepares to punish NATO states for Iran rift. UK may face, quote, reckoning after audit of war effort. Mm. That's a story really about where Trump met with that Mark Rutte the other day. Yeah. They had a very frank conversation. It was characterised as. And now Trump making noises again about pulling out of NATO, the US pulling out of NATO. And now he's talking about an audit. That's the word that's getting thrown around now.
Yeah.
In other words, from the American side of it, saying, wait, stop everything. What exactly have you or haven't you spent money on? How much money exactly have or haven't you given us for NATO, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? The idea being, you can only imagine, obviously, is that then he can point to it and go, look, you haven't been doing what you're supposed to be doing. An audit of it. And you can say it's sort of as some sort of punishment.
Yeah. Well, the punishment, one of the punishments that has been proposed by the White House, I think it's very interesting because it does represent a tectonic shifting in the, I think, global political landscape.
Oh, yeah.
And that is essentially withdrawing troops from NATO member states, specifically in Europe, who Trump feels hasn't done their part in the Iran war, and moving them to countries that have. And this is interesting because actually the AfD in Germany, for example, this week were calling for that. They were calling for US troops to be, you know, withdrawn from Germany. And I mean, I do think there's a conversation to be had about the fact that many of, you know, the countries of Europe have been occupied by the US military for a very long time. And actually whether it would be a good thing for that to happen, whether it would be a good thing, for example, for Britain to have less of a, you know, intimate relationship with the US, because has it been serving us? I mean, I don't think so. I think now they're more of a liability to us than they are a help. So it's interesting that's being framed as a punishment, but actually a lot of the people of Europe are looking at the prospect of less involvement with the US, less US presence in their country, and thinking, actually, yes, we want that.
Mm. It is interesting that Trump would say something like, along the lines of, well, we might pull loads of money and men and material and bases out of, let's say, Germany, and at least AfD, at least patriotic Germans are like, yes, please.
Right. Finally.
Haven't we been asking for that since, like, the 80s or something? Mm. Like, yeah, go ahead. Mm. Yeah, please do.
Yeah.
I mean, even in Britain, there's quite a lot of US bases.
Yes.
Air bases. Quite a lot. And there were, and just like in Germany and all over Europe, they're a leftover from the Cold War. Mm. They're a leftover from the Cold War. And I don't necessarily, being an Anglo-American myself, I don't necessarily, on the broadest sense, want to have less ties with the United States. I certainly wouldn't want our government to fall more into the hands of China or anything. But we don't need these Cold War bases all over Germany, all over Britain, all over various parts of Europe. I don't think we need, I don't think it's in our interest particularly. I don't think America enjoy it. It's annoying to them now, isn't it? It seems.
Yeah, I'll tell you something else that I find quite concerning. I only learnt this recently and I'm no expert on military matters. But the UK's nuclear deterrent is not independent or sovereign of the United States.
We buy Trident wholesale off of the,
exactly,
the Yanks.
And our submarines are only equipped to carry Trident missiles. Yeah. So there's no way for us, and I mean, the warheads and the submarines are manufactured in Britain, but the actual payloads themselves, we, yeah, they're manufactured and leased for America, and we have to go there and pick them up. Yeah. And so if there was a souring of relations between the UK and the US for any reason, suddenly we would be without an independent nuclear deterrent. And I'm no fan of nuclear proliferation, but we live in an era where if you don't have a big stick, you know, you might be in trouble.
Yeah.
And so I don't like the fact that we don't have this sort of military independence from the US. And it's been interesting watching Starmer in the way he's navigated the Iran war, especially in an intervention that he made in The Guardian, I think yesterday, or it may have been this morning, where he basically, in very vague terms, laid out an agenda for self-sufficiency and sovereignty in key strategic sectors, which again, I mean, I'm no fan of Starmer, but this is the kind of thing we've been saying, right? We've been saying that, look at the fact that we import, you know, 40% of our food. Look at the fact that 80% of prescription drugs are imported from China and India. Look at the fact that we import a huge amount of energy when in the early 2000s we were a net energy exporter. Mm. And the way in which Starmer has framed this, and indeed the Labour government more generally, is using the Iran war and the shock to, you know, energy prices and so on to double down on net zero and double down on the need for, you know, wind farms and solar farms and all the rest of it. And I'm not instinctively against having some of that. I mean, like a diversified energy sector, I don't think is necessarily a bad thing, especially in the volatile world in which we live. But nevertheless, I mean, we need to have a conversation about North Sea drilling and gas and not buying our own gas off the Norwegians when we could just drill it ourselves and all the rest of it.
Have the odd offshore wind farm, but
yeah.
But I mean, is Restore all about drilling in the North Sea?
Yeah, well, we're just about energy self-sufficiency and making it as cheap and abundant as possible by any means necessary. If that means having some wind farms, fine. If that means drilling, fine. You know, anything. We're actually going to publish our energy policy, a comprehensive paper, in the coming weeks. So stay tuned for that.
Great.
And we can go into more detail at that time. But I think as a general rule, as a general principle, energy sovereignty is crucial. So it's interesting to see Starmer saying the same thing.
It feels to me like stating the obvious. Mm. Why would any country, if it was possible, if it was physically possible, why would any country not strain every sinew to be self-sufficient in energy?
Yeah.
Why would you not? Yeah. If you've got massive North Sea oil reserves or even giant coal seams still, like in Newcastle or Wales or whatever, like, oh, you might piss off a few Just Stop Oil activists by opening a coal mine again or something. Don't care.
Who cares? If they stand in the road, put them in prison.
We need to be sufficient for energy. Thank you very much. And food, actually. Mm. go back to the world, dig for victory. Everyone's got to have a little allotment. I'm joking about that, of course, but but
it's important.
It would be nice, though, wouldn't it, not to have to import 40% of your food?
Yeah, I think according to the Department of Agriculture, 75% of indigenous foods, which is to say foods that we could grow commercially in the UK, 25% we import from overseas. Why aren't we growing that in country?
Yeah.
Like, it makes no sense.
Yeah, I get that we can't grow bananas and limes.
Sure, but we can survive without them, I think.
But we shouldn't have to need to, ideally, have to import any potatoes, let's say. Right? Yeah. Oh, okay.
It's absurd. And so it's just interesting to see. And as I say, he did it in very vague terms, and he sort of talked about, and he said, we should not be at the mercy, this is Starmer in the garden, we should not be at the mercy of events abroad, and we need to tackle key defence and social policies. And he basically just, runs his usual spiel. But as a signal, it's interesting to hear, what I perceive, interpret as being a distancing from the US and a desire for more self-sufficiency in the UK, which I think is only a good thing, even if it's coming from Starmer.
Yeah. Yeah, I've always said I'm prepared to give someone credit where it's due. Mm. I've always said, if course, Ed Davey started coming out with based things and I believe that he meant them, I'd be like, good, good, great, that's nice to hear.
Yeah.
And so the odd, every now and again, very, very rarely, but when Starmer comes out with something I agree with, I'll say so.
Yeah.
Same with Nigel even.
Yeah.
If they say something where I'm like, okay, good.
Yeah.
Then I'll give them credit.
Of course.
And Starmer's been... he's not wrong, is he?
No.
He's not wrong.
Of course he's not. And let's not forget, by the way, on that topic, that if, we were living under a reform or indeed a conservative government at this time, we would be, fully involved in this war. Because both Badenoch and Farage and Tice and Zahawi and all of these, establishment conservatives came out on day one and said, let's get involved. We should be supporting our greatest ally in their war with Iran. And that would have been utterly disastrous. So where Starmer didn't do that, I think he deserves credit. And I'm not saying he's handled it amazingly well, but he certainly handled it better than I think Farage would have, certainly.
Yeah. He didn't immediately just say, yes, sir, anything you want, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can always rely on rely on the Conservative Party to do whatever the State Department says now.
Yeah.
Like the State Department does a 180 on something and the Tory Party just fall in line with it. Not 100% of the time, but very nearly.
It will be interesting in the coming years, especially in the UK-British context, to see how the association with Trump that Farage has will affect his reputation. Because Trump's already, and has been for a long time, very unpopular in Britain. And it's only becoming more unpopular as a result of this war. I mean, the war itself is massively unpopular in Britain. And 8 out of 10 people, I think, are actively concerned about costs of energy and food and all the rest of it. I mean, I filled up my car yesterday. It was £2 a litre for diesel. It's like, what are we doing here? And so
you drive a diesel?
Yeah, I do. I know, in this day and age. But the association that reform has with MAGA is, I think, will become a bit of a burden for them.
Yeah, it's not ideal. Probably will be. Although, is it not true? I don't know this about this in fantastic detail. But is it not true that Trump's distanced himself from Nigel a little bit? Certainly since the 2016 era, when you saw it, did seem like they were properly friends.
Yeah,
doesn't seem as much so anymore. But there's still definitely some sort of connection there, isn't it? Which I don't think will serve them all that well. Probably.
I think Trump has definitely, it seems as though he has distanced himself from Farage, but I don't think Farage has really distanced himself from Trump.
Right.
He still presents himself as being friends with Trump, despite the fact that Trump's not popular here.
Yeah. Okay, you mentioned oil and diesel prices. Should we have a quick look at the price of oil in real time? Yeah. I like to do this now on the show a little bit. Still under $100 a barrel.
Yep.
West Texas, surprisingly a touch more than Brent. West Texas, just under $100. Yeah. Brent, sort of 96, 97. So it's only a couple of bucks up from this time yesterday. Remember when the war started, it was just shy of $80 a barrel, about $78 a barrel. So what I think's a bit unfair, it's just, what's not right to me is that the price at the petrol pump doesn't seem to really reflect the price of crude. Like, people trying to fill up their car are punished much harder than crude oil commodities traders.
Yeah.
That's not fair, is it?
No.
Bloody hell, come on. It's the way of the world, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the way of the world.
But this is the thing. I mean, this is what most people actually care about, right? It's how much it costs to fill up their car.
To buy a bit of cheese.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And this war is meaning that all of those things are becoming more expensive and less stable, and it's looking, you know, more and more... the future's looking more and more uncertain. And therefore, it's not surprising that this war is so unpopular. Yeah. So I think any sensible, right-thinking, you know, Britain first force, like Restore Britain, is going to say we should have no part in this war. None.
Yeah, yeah. Protect ourselves domestically from any potential Iranian terrorist cells.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
In fact, give more money to the police and MI5 to combat that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, actually getting involved in like, full-scale...
Yeah.
Blowing up people in Persia.
Yeah. It's just ridiculous.
Not so much up for that.
And this
really.
Is the thing, like the war itself is just ridiculous because we know, it's a matter of public record, that this was an Israeli operation, that they told the Americans, we're going to do this whether you like it or not.
Yeah, and Rubio did say that, didn't he?
Rubio said it on national television.
He just said that. Yeah.
And so they just followed them into this. There's no plan, there's no strategy. And it just begs the question, like, why can't the Americans rein in what should be, what is on paper, like a client state? What's going on here?
Yeah, I wonder if and when Trump finds an off-ramp and he wants Netanyahu to stop, whether he will. I think that will be the litmus test. Whether at that point Netanyahu will be like, no thanks, we're going to do what we want, or whether he'll fall in line.
Well, I think the ceasefire is the prime example of that. They just bombed Lebanon.
Yeah.
Beirut. It's not even where Hezbollah are based.
Yeah, I mean, 300-odd people died in the last 24 hours or so in Lebanon, I believe.
Yeah.
And then, like, another 200-odd or so the day before that.
Mm.
So, yeah, it looks like Israel are not going to stop.
And you've got the finance minister, so not a minor figure, Smotrich, I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, coming out, I think this morning or last night, saying that we're going to be expanding the borders of Israel into Lebanon, into Gaza, into Syria. You know, this is the greater Israel project, which we're told is some kind of conspiracy. Like, you've got a literal senior Israeli government minister coming out and saying, yeah, we're going to do this. It's like, it's just imperialism. I don't want to sound like a leftist, but like, it's just imperialism. And the idea that the UK should have any part in that is just absurd. It doesn't benefit us in any way. In fact, it's actually anathema. And it's against our interests to be involved in anything like that. Not least for the fact that they appear to be just indiscriminately murdering people, children.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bottom line. Is it in Britain's interest, Israel's various wars? No, I mean, I can buy the argument to some... Or I buy the argument on a conceptual level. It's best if the Iranian regime and Islamic theocracy doesn't have nuclear weapons.
Yes, well, I mean, that's common sense.
Okay, yeah. You know, there's hardly anyone that's going to disagree with that. Okay, I'm on board with that, I agree with that, yes. But beyond that, I certainly don't want a single British serviceman to be wounded or maimed, let alone killed, for Israel.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So...
And on that, by the way, I mean, you know, if the narrative is to be believed, Iran was cooperating before the war in, you know... disarming their nuclear.
I don't know.
But at the same time, by the way, the Iranians will have been looking at, you know, what happened in Libya, for example, and saying, well, you know, when we abide by the US's demands to disarm, you just invade us anyway and kill our leaders. It's like the North Korea principle. It's like, we're going to have nukes, so you don't do this. And I'm not saying that makes it right, and I'm not saying they should have nuclear weapons. But at the same time, you can't, you know, in a way, you can understand the mindset when they've been looking at US foreign policy for the last, what, however many decades? Certainly as long as I've been alive.
Since the late 70s.
Yeah.
Ever since the 1979 revolution.
Mm.
Well, there was the Tehran embassy siege, the US embassy in Tehran in 1979. Which lasted for ages, like 400 plus days.
Yeah.
Well over a year in the Jimmy Carter. So from moment one, the United States and Iran, the Iranian Islamic regime, have been absolutely at loggerheads with each other. But okay, let's move on then quickly here, because it's already gone half past.
Crikey.
The Daily Telegraph, the Tory Graph, a lot of the same. There's Melania there, looking radiant. Well, nearly. She's not quite a Catherine, is she? But I had no relationship with Epstein. All right, we've talked about that. Should we just move on? What have we got in the IR paper? I usually like to read the blurb because it gives us crazily, some of the best journalism you get in the print media is the front page of the IR paper of all things. Russia used the channel to move war, quote, war suppliers as threat to UK from Putin escalates, they say. Iran war emboldens Kremlin as submarines, quote, spy on British cables. Fuel for food and spare parts for Putin's armed forces believed to be taken through English Channel on two sanctioned Russian tankers escorted by a Kremlin warship. Blacklisted tanker carrying shipments of Moscow's military... shipments of Moscow's military accompanied through UK waters by the ship, the Admiral Grigorovich, a frigate armed with cruise and surface-to-air missiles. Defence Secretary also reveals three Russian submarines tried to spy on underwater data cables in UK waters and warns that Putin poses, quote, primary threat to UK security, quote. I think the Labour Party is guilty of that. Anyway, Healey said, quote, no damage, quote, was done, but accused Russia of using, quote, a distraction of the Iran war with frigate, with fragile ceasefire under strain as the Israel and Lebanon prepare for talks. Sorry, that writing is just on the limit of what my vision can read. So sorry about that. All right, so we talk about Russia now. Talk about the Ruskies a little bit. Mm. So, yeah, they sent through a few tankers that we'd sanctioned. Said they're ghost tankers. They're, what do they call them? Zombie tankers. Mm. If we could, we'd send Royal Marines or the SBS on board to just take those. So which we've done before in recent times, done a number of times over the years and in recent times. So they sent at least one of their, I don't know if it's a frigate or a destroyer or something, the Admiral Grigorovich, to escort it so we wouldn't do that, which we then didn't. And anyway, the bigger sort of meta point is the escalation of tensions with Russia.
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts and feelings about that in the most general sense?
Well, it's an obvious point to make, but it's not surprising that when we are allowing thousands of, you know, unvetted, primarily, you know, men, like adult men from the Middle East and North Africa to pour across the English Channel into our country, you know, completely unopposed, that a power like Russia would look at that situation and think, okay, so they have no defence in their, you know, in their, essentially their southern border, their, you know, the English Channel. Therefore, we're just going to do what we want there. And that appears to be what they've done. And Healy's response was, we see you. Mm. And it just came across as so impotent to me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, it sort of is. We sort of are. I mean, I remember this so clearly. It was a long time ago. This was when David Miliband was the foreign secretary. So that must have been at the end or in the Gordon Brown years. And Putin does this thing, doesn't he, or has done in the past, where he'll be the president of Russia for a while, and then he'll let someone like Medvedev be the president for a while, and he's merely the prime minister now, and then for a few years. But obviously, he's still the leader.
Yes.
He's obviously, all policy still rests with him, obviously so. And Medvedev just does whatever he's told. Mm. And then after a period of that, a few years of that, legally, Putin's then allowed to run for president again and just does it again. It's just a way of keeping himself perpetually in power.
Yes.
Anyway, I remember back in the David Miliband foreign secretary years, him writing, I think it might have been in the Telegraph actually, him writing a piece doing this finger wagging thing. Mr. Putin, we see you. Mr. Putin, you better not keep doing this anymore. It's not acceptable.
Yeah.
Like a teacher.
It's pathetic.
And it's obviously super, super lame. Mm. As if Putin cares what David Miliband's like,
yeah,
as if he cares about John Healey saying we see you. He's like, yeah, yeah, I know yeah,
that's
we
the
see
point.
You seeing us, yeah, yeah. What now? Yeah.
You think like you think they were trying to do this secretly, like there's, you know, I think it's who knows, but this seems to be a show of strength. We see you is the point is to be seen,
right? Yeah. It's not, they're not scared. And the other point there, I suppose, is that there's some underground, undersea cables, sensitive data cables and pipelines and things in the North Sea. And they sent three different submarines there, but they didn't do any damage. But again, I think it's very much like when they buzz the airspace, so-called buzz the airspace, they send fast jets right up to our airspace and even maybe slightly inside and then turn around.
Yeah.
It's like, Yeah, they're not trying to do it covertly. Oh. It's not actually like a spy mission.
Yeah,
the point is that we see them do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what are you going to do?
Yeah. What are you going to do about it is exactly what Putin is saying.
Yeah. So ultimately, my fear is, and I don't think this will happen, but my fear is that the hawks, like in the establishment, that are for some reason despise Russia, like really, really despise them, despite the Ukraine conflict. Even if the Ukraine conflict wasn't a thing, they would still have this, what I think is a leftover from the Cold War type thing, of despising Russia. Don't know really where it comes from exactly, but if they somehow got their way, or there was some miscalculation somewhere, and we just found ourselves in an exchange of kinetic weapons with the Russians, maybe in the North Sea, and no one, hardly anyone, I think, wants that. Hardly anyone, normal people of Britain, absolutely don't want that.
Yeah,
and yet we might. Again, I think, I hope it won't happen, but that could happen now.
Mm.
There's some sort of miscommunication in the North Sea, and something gets fired at this Russian ship, and the Russian ship, it's just automatic, they fire back.
Mm.
And now it's a bit more than just a diplomatic hoo-ha.
Yes.
It's like, wait, are we at war with Russia?
Mm.
And we've got a tiny army and almost no navy really to speak of.
Yeah.
Like, wait, what just happened? Surely that's like the worry, isn't it?
Well, this is, again, like, you know, a lot of this is over my head, Bo, to be honest. But I don't really understand why there is this kind of real hatred between the British and Russian security establishments. Because if you listen to, you know, sort of figures from the British, you know, military and intelligence apparatus talking about the threats that are posed to Britain, they'd always say Russia is number one. Maybe that's true, right? Because, I mean, Russia is certainly no friend of NATO, right?
Of course.
Although they were trying to join it years back. But leaving that to one side, you know, do I think that Russia is like is our friend? Well, obviously not.
No.
But the idea
that they're
the number one threat to Britain is just it's strange to me, and I don't know what that's about. And you listen to, for example, Boris Johnson, who was of course the Prime Minister during the Ukraine war, which is obviously still ongoing, and his and since leaving office, the way that he just is always every week Ukraine, Russia. It's always that one issue that he chooses to champion. Mm. Why? Like, what, to quote Tucker Carlson, what is that?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't a bigger threat to the stability of our society from giant enclaves of foreign nationals which seem to rape and murder at an extraordinary rate per capita?
Yeah,
isn't that a bigger threat?
Yeah,
to the individual people than
one would think.
The Kremlin.
One would think. I mean, look, my view is that we should have good relations with people, like, as a general rule. Like, obviously, if they prod us and threaten us, we shouldn't take that, and we should stand up to them. And if Putin's going to say, what are you going to do about it? We should do something about it, right? That doesn't mean start a war, obviously, but it does mean make it clear that we're not going to be pushed around as a nation. Because I think the perception is on the world stage that Britain can be pushed around, frankly.
To be clear on this as well, I have to always make it clear whenever I talk about this stuff, because people will say, oh, you're in the pay of the Russians. Why are you being a Putin apologist? Yeah. No. I've said before, he's a gangster and a murderer.
Yeah.
He murders political opponents and unfriendly journalists.
Yeah.
Quite a lot.
Mm.
He's not a good guy.
And makes no secret of that.
And we are strategically enemies. Mm. Yes. I accept that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've read a lot about this. I'm fascinated by the Cold War and everything that went on between Britain and Russia during the Cold War. And it's all still ongoing now, but massively dialed down. All throughout the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s, massive amounts of espionage between the Soviets and our security services in London, in Britain.
Yeah.
Loads. It's crazy how much, really. Mm. And it all still goes on, but just way dialed down.
Right.
But it all just still goes on. So it's not that I'm pro-Putin, I'm pro-Kremlin.
No.
I'm not. He is a gangster.
Yeah.
But I just don't buy the angle that we need to sort of poke the Russian bear in the eye every single day.
Yeah. Are there not bigger concerns?
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, so this picture on the front of The Independent is quite striking. Royal Navy and Russian warships very near to each other. It's a little bit alarming.
Yeah.
A little bit alarming. I suspect our guys, the Royal Navy, are under very strict orders, you know, don't fire anything.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, obviously, unless you're fired on. But then that's the thing. If the Russians, for whatever reason, even if it was an accident, even if it was a miscommunication, and they do fire something at us, you know, it's quite possible that things start going into automatic mode.
Of course.
Yeah. The captain on the ship has got no choice but to fire back, because of military doctrine and stuff. And then, once again, we're at war with Russia now, are we?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. We see you. Putin warned over spy subs in UK waters. Yeah, I bet he's shaking in his boots. Yeah. I bet he's shaking in his boots. All right, the mirror. Again, we see you, Vlad. Again, look, they're quite close to each other, aren't they? If anyone's watching this, you can see with your own two eyeballs, but if anyone is only listening to it, there's Russian and British ships of war pretty close to each other in the sea.
And again, the timing of it is interesting because it's almost like whilst our leaders are dealing with the Iran situation and Starmer is trying to, as he does, mediate between the various parties, Russia pokes their head and says, we're still here.
Yeah.
Almost as like a... taunting them in this moment of in this very fragile moment.
Yeah. So you got your hands full, have you guys?
Yeah.
Interesting to know. Yeah. But that's the other thing I'd say about Russia is that they've very much got their hands full. Mm. I mean, the Russian military capabilities have been shown in Ukraine to be not exactly world beating, are they? Mm. I mean, it's a difficult war, actually, when you drill down into sort of the day-to-day tactical realities of the war in the Donbass.
Yeah.
It's a pretty tough war, actually. Mm. But nonetheless, Putin wasn't able to just tie that up with a nice bow in, like, 2 weeks flat, was he? Okay, so The Guardian, so gross. Netanyahu calls for Lebanon talks after Israel airstrikes condemned. So, yeah, Bibi's not stopping, is he? If anything, he feels like he might be forced by Rubio and Trump to stop. So this is the last moment to put your foot on the gas right now, if anything.
Yeah, certainly.
He might only have days left to do some bombing, so he's going to get as much in as possible.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And beyond that, I mean, I do wonder whether the Israelis chose this moment to, one, start the war with Iran, and then to be completely unrelenting in their, you know, in their attacks on Iran and Lebanon and all the rest of it, because they know they're never going to get another Trump, right? Because American, European, British public opinion of Israel and the war in Iran is so bad now, they know they're never going to have another shot like this one with somebody as, frankly, I mean, I don't want to say weak, but you know, like the way that Trump has been in relation to the Israelis is utterly supine, right? Are they going to get another shot like that? Maybe not. Maybe I think they probably think they won't. So they're just doing it all now.
It's funny on that because Trump... So there's like clips of Trump from years back, years before he was president, saying things like, if it was up to me, Iran would never be able to get a nuclear weapon. Mm. So there's that.
Obviously sensible.
But then there's tweets he did during the George W. Bush era, again, long before he was president, the first time even, saying adventures in the Middle East are disastrous and insane and not in US interest.
Of course, that's what he won in 2016 on.
Right, I'm the never forever war guy. But then when he did get in 2016, one of the first things he said was about Iran and that they can't have a nuclear weapon. But then I'm not into forever wars, look how many wars I've solved, etc. And one story that Netanyahu himself said just a couple of weeks ago, when Trump got in the second time, Netanyahu went to Mar-a-Lago sort of right away. And apparently the anecdote was something like, as soon as Netanyahu walked into the room, Trump said to him first, we're going to do something about Iran, right, Bibi?
Right.
That's according to Bibi. But okay, the point is I'm trying to make with all of that is that Trump has both been very bellicose about it for years, but has also been against giant foreign adventures which aren't in the interest directly in the interest of the United States. So you can make the argument both ways. But yeah, something seems to have changed though, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Something seems to have changed from his first term to this term with regards to... And then there was that guy, Joseph Kent. And there was some reporting that J.D. Vance was against it and Trump just completely overruled him.
Yeah.
Or there's a story a few weeks back, or a week or more ago, that J.D. Vance was on the phone to Netanyahu having a go at him, saying, you missold this to us.
Yes.
Whether all that's true or not. Both sides played that down. But yeah.
There was one, I think it was in the New York Times, distancing Rubio, Vance and others at the top of the American government from this whole thing and basically trying to pin the whole thing on Trump and Hegseth.
Yes. It's
very interesting manoeuvring.
There was a story about a week ago and it said that Vance rung up Netanyahu and said, you missold this to us. You mischaracterized it to the Donald. You said this would be a piece of cake. Mm. You said we need to take out the Ayatollah and it's done. What now?
Yeah.
But both sides played that reporting down.
Yes.
But all right. Let's see what else have we got. The Financial Times. Oil prices spike over $100 a barrel. It's under $100 a barrel. Mm. All right. The Express. It's a good paper. This is a different story. I'll talk about it very briefly. It says, blockaded by French fuel protests. All it is a story that Corsica, which is a little island in the Med between Spain and Italy, which completely belongs to France. It's just French territory. Some French fishermen people are doing a protest and blockading some of the ports in Corsica, preventing some cruise ships, well, all the cruise ships from leaving.
Right.
So, and there's some Brits affected, British tourists affected. So, there you go. It's a little bit of a story. For some reason, the Express believes that's front page news today.
Yeah.
All right, there's Melania again. And the headline says, now red Ed's green idiocy halts AI deal worth billions. And it's the story that, what is it, OpenAI, the company that does ChatGPT, were going to invest billions in Britain and build a big base, a big hub.
Yeah.
Here and now they've just said we're not going to because of red tape and energy costs.
Do you know what's interesting about this? Tony Blair must be seething about this because I'm reading his book.
Because he loves AI, doesn't he?
This is the thing. So I'm reading On Leadership, which is his most recent book. It's a very interesting book. And it's so funny because it's kind of part sober, objective analysis of, you know, the art of government or whatever. And it's very interesting for that reason, just to hear about his view of these things. But it's also part manifesto, quite explicitly. It's about, here's what's important, here's what you should be prioritizing.
He can't help himself, I imagine.
He can't. Yeah. And I mean, there's plenty on there on digital ID. There's plenty on AI. And this thing, his obsession with AI is so apparent in this book. And something that he says is that having data centers in your country is going to be an essential kind of, essential strategic infrastructure moving into the middle and late 21st century, because AI is the technology of this era, and you have to use it in government, you have to use it in business, you have to use it everywhere, you have to apply it to all problems and your society will get much better. And I'm very skeptical of that view. I understand where he's coming from, obviously, because it's powerful technology, but there's a reason that he has actually distanced himself from net zero, I think, and that's because he recognizes that it's driving up the cost of energy and making it very difficult for AI companies to set up business in Britain and in any country that prioritizes, you know, green energy and all the rest of it. So it's interesting to see this discord between the Blairites and the kind of, I don't know, the net zero faction of the Labour Party.
So at least in the Dark Lord's mind, Tony Blair, Knight of the Garter, if he had to choose between green energy and AI, he's picking the AI side of that ledger every time.
Which dystopia do you want? Green dystopia or AI dystopia? And he's on the AI side of that.
Yeah, debate. Crazy. Okay, so...
just to be clear, but just very quickly on this.
Yeah,
this is obviously a bad thing. Like, we should be attracting business and everything to our country.
Sure.
And I do think, obviously, AI is the technology of the future. Now, how we use it and how it's regulated is a different question. I'm not so convinced as Blair is that it's this kind of silver bullet, one size fits all solution to everything, which is what he seems to think it is. But nevertheless, it's bad that we have energy policies that mean that companies like ChatGPT aren't interested in doing business with us. That's a bad thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And beyond just AI, beyond AI companies, like OpenAI, all right, but loads and loads and loads of different companies, all sorts of manufacturing, any type of company really, just flee this country because it's ruinously expensive.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. It's ruinously expensive for them. We'll just move to, anywhere else.
Yeah.
Like Ireland. Yeah. Loads of companies move to Ireland. Mm. Or Indonesia.
Yeah.
Vietnam, anywhere that isn't ruinously expensive.
I'll tell you something
to,
else
to run.
That is interesting as well is, I'm just going to plot the quote here, about the relationship between immigration and AI. It's a little bit off topic, but I think it's kind of interesting. But Alex Karp, CEO of Palantir, of course, he said recently that it's the trends in AI that Blair is talking about and all the rest of it make it hard to imagine why we should have large-scale immigration unless you have a very specialized skill. And people like him, as well as Larry Fink, have all said that actually mass low-skill immigration of the type that Britain has indulged in over the last 30 years is actually an inhibitor to AI innovation, specifically AI innovation,
right,
in your country. So it's interesting, like the relationship between these two articles of faith for our ruling class, which is net zero and mass immigration, the way in which then those two things are now kind of turning things around on them and making it very difficult for them to embrace this, you know, this so-called technology of the future. Blair, again, must be seething.
Classic, yeah. One slight point I'll make is I deeply, deeply distrust AI.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
I would not be interested in having a... Oh, maybe he's right that there's just no... Well, he's probably right that there's no real avoiding it. It is already the technology of the future, and if you're not on board, you will just simply get left behind. Okay,
it's classic
true, but
everything, to be fair.
But I mean, if it was entirely up to me, if I was hegemon of the whole world, let's put it that way, I would ramp down a lot of AI stuff. I would John Connor it.
Yeah,
I'd destroy it all.
I do think something very interesting. A few years back, you'll remember Tucker Carlson did an interview with Ben Shapiro in which he said he would gladly, if he was president, block the introduction of kind of self-driving lorries and all that sort of thing, because lorry driving is the main employer of a huge number of Americans, and if AI was to be introduced in that industry, it would put millions of people out of work, which would obviously be a bad thing. And it's like, in the name of efficiency and profit and all the rest of it, it might be good. And Ben Shapiro was arguing for those reasons that it would be good to automate these kinds of things. Mm. But it is interesting. I mean, how are we going to deal with the unemployment that AI and automation is going to cause? I mean, Blair is right to say that's one of the sort of key problems of our age. You know, how are we going to navigate that? And I'm with you broadly. I think that, you know, even if it could be shown that AI and automation are going to lead to, you know, X percentage increase in profits and efficiency and, you know, reduction in overheads and all the rest of it, if it puts millions of people out of work, and then we're going to have some kind of like universal, UBI, universal credit thing, like, is that good? Is that good for our society? The line on the graph is going up, sure, but is that good for us? I don't think it is.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. My concern is even broader than that. It's that, and I know artificial intelligence at the moment isn't truly intelligent in any real sense. There's still LLMs, right? Large language models, basically. But my fear is that, and I'm talking about decades, maybe even centuries into the future, that we don't know what it would lead to, and it could well lead to truly disastrous things, much, much more bigger and more profound than unemployment.
Yes.
It could lead to things that we can't even truly imagine at this point, where AI is allowed to control all sorts of elements of human existence. Mm. And we become, I don't want to sound too alarmist to tinfoil hat, but we in various senses become a slave to it.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily talking about like in the Terminator universe, where we're quite literally, or the Matrix universe, where we're actually slaves to it, but in various senses.
Yeah. I think a lot of people already are. In a way.
Yeah, or even that it just robs people of the essential elements of their humanity.
I've got to say, I mean, where I've used it in the past, and I have used it in the past, like, I have felt it make me more dumb. Honestly, like,
really?
that's the only way.
Because I never use it. I never, ever use it.
It's one of those.
I've generated like 3 images on Grok ever.
Yeah,
I've never generated a single piece of text.
Yeah.
With AI in my life.
It's one of those things, and there's a few things in life like this that we all have encountered where you do a bit of it and you're looking down and you're thinking, do I want to go down that path? It doesn't feel right. Like this, you know, it feels... And again, the only way I can put it is it felt like it was making me dumber when I was using it.
Yeah.
Because you're outsourcing your own thinking to this thing that isn't actually really thinking. It just gives you the illusion of thinking.
I don't want to do that.
No.
I actively, proactively don't want that for myself.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't want it for humanity.
No.
But okay.
So what you're saying, though, is that net zero and mass immigration are good because it means that we can't have Terminator in Britain.
Exactly.
Perfect.
All right, we're getting towards the top of there. We can go past 9, of course. There's no massive restriction. But let's have a quick look at what we've got on the Sun. The Sun, if anyone didn't know, it's the Grand National at Aintree this Saturday or tomorrow. The Sun goes with, as Aintree fever grips the UK, and he's off his head. And they're talking about Dave Paulden, real name, Zach Polansky, real name Dave Paulden. This freak, this absolute freak, as well, the leader of the Green Party, Dave Paulden. Calling himself Zach Polansky for some reason. And he says he wants to ban horse racing. He wants to ban horse racing and put a tax on owning a dog, but legalise all drugs, including heroin, crack, and legalise prostitution. And of course, complete open borders. That's the sort of Britain Dave Paulden wants for you.
This is why, I mean, look, I've said a couple of things recently about the Greens, and the fact that, look, there is a reason that they're popular. We actually do have to address the problems that they are, at the very least, diagnosing with our society, like wealth inequality and all that sort of thing. Statistic that blew my mind the other day was the difference between the household wealth of those who own their own home outright and those who are renting is so big. It's like household owners, or homeowners rather, average wealth is about £600,000. Renters, about £40,000. 15 times larger, right? Yeah. That's serious inequality. And obviously, that's largely generational as well. So there is a sense among the young, which is why they're doing so well in the under 50s, under 30s demographic, leading in those two demographics, the Greens. There is a feeling that wealth is concentrating in the hands of fewer and fewer people, particularly those over the age of 60 or, you know, whatever. You know, we can't own our own homes. Like, that's a distant prospect for many of us. We're all renting. We're all working jobs where the wage isn't good and the tax is massive and we're watching our high streets and towns, you know, deteriorate and all that sort of thing. This guy, Zach Polansky, comes along and says, we're going to fix this all for you by just arbitrarily stealing money from the wealthiest in our society. A lot of people, they say, he's at least listening. Like, he's at least listening to the problems that we have. Because you look at the likes of Labour and Reform and the Conservatives, and they don't seem even prepared to address this issue, which is an issue for a lot of people. But the rest of their agenda, I mean, the wealth taxes, you know, as one policy, are obviously stupid because they won't work. They've never worked anywhere they've been tried in the, I think, 15 countries they've been attempted in the last 50 years. Never worked. So they won't work to kind of alleviate that wealth inequality and will, in fact, exacerbate a lot of the problems that we've got. You add to that the open borders, the further liberalisation of immigration that they want to bring through, that's going to massively accelerate the deterioration as well. And so I think the key thing with the Greens is saying, look, we understand where they're coming from when they address, when they identify this and this problem with our country, but people need to understand what exactly their program would do to this country. The people who are looking at the Greens and thinking, do you know what, I might take a punt on them because they're at least prepared to listen to the problems that ordinary people have. What they would actually do to the country if they were in power or if they were in coalition with Labour or whatever, it would be so bad. It would be so disastrous.
Of course, yeah.
That it would make Britain, the Britain of today, look positively utopian, in my view. And so I think, you know, just educating, like a campaign of public education about what the Greens actually want to do to Britain, I think is very important.
Yeah.
And showing that there is an alternative. And look, I mean, obviously Restore, I'm going to say Restore is that alternative because we are prepared to address the fact that, yeah, it's impossible to own your own home if you're a young person. Yeah, your wages are probably pretty poor, especially, you know, compared to your parents, for example, when they were the same age as you. Tax is absolutely intolerable. And the social and cultural breakdown of our civilization is evident everywhere, wherever you go. These are all true things. But the solution to that is not what ultimately amounts to more of the same. Because this is the thing with the Greens. The right way to understand them is not as radicals. They wear the costume of radicalism quite convincingly. But what they actually represent, their policies, mass immigration, you know, green, like net zero to the max, liberalization in the kind of social realm, drugs, prostitution, and all the rest of it. And by the way, this very strange alliance that they have with Islam, sectarian Islam in the United Kingdom, what this represents is just more of the same. That's what we've had for the last 30 years in this country. And so what they're saying is the solution to the problems caused by those policies is to lean even further into them, to do more of it, more intensely and quicker. And actually our position is actually what we should be doing, say, is saying enough to all of this. No more mass immigration, no more Islam, no more net zero, none of this nonsense, right? We just put Britain first, put the British people and their interests first. You don't have to do all this crazy stuff. It's common sense. Right?
Yeah. So what you're saying is the Green Party have got some interesting points. The boomers are a lot richer than the Zoomers. Yeah. So eat the rich is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Revolution okay. now. Yeah, exactly. I'm a Bolshevik. Okay. Yeah.
We should go down the route of Marxist-Leninism. Got it. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
No. No, it's mad, isn't it? It's mad. If they got into power, they would truly speed. You think Labour's speed running us off a cliff? Dave Paulden, Zach Polansky, real name Dave Paulden, would truly speed run straight off a cliff.
Yeah.
Okay. Quick whip through the last couple of front pages. Just this guy. This is an odd story. The Metro, yep. Disgusting rag that it is,
yep.
Decided to go with this story that somewhere in London, a pub in London, in Soho, a Fabergé egg had been on display somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And a woman, an executive, just had it in her handbag, an actual Fabergé egg.
As one does.
A czarist era Easter present from Tsar Nicholas to his wife, or the other way around.
Yep.
She had a Fabergé egg just in her handbag,
yep.
As well as a matching watch. And this Algerian immigrant stole it and then sold it for a pittance to buy some drugs. And it's never been recovered.
Homeless Algerian Enzo Conticello.
Great.
In Britain.
It's sort of like a really bad, horrible comedy sketch.
It's just...
How is that real? How can those events have...
I know. It happens more and more these days, where you'll just have these stories that, like, just every aspect of it is just like, yeah. What? It's yeah. Like, okay, so this woman has a 2 million quid Fabergé egg from Tsarist Russia in her handbag, and then this homeless Algerian steals it off her in London.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. What? Yeah. This happens in a pub yeah. in Soho.
Yeah.
And then he obviously, you can only imagine, didn't really know what he had.
Yeah.
It's worth 2 million quid at auction or something.
Well, what you're saying, he looks like a very lucid individual to me.
He knows all about, late 19th century priceless objet d'art. Yeah, no, don't think so. Anyway, but it's never been recovered.
Yeah.
So, all right. I think the final one, this story, horrible. I think this guy's Nigerian. Again, he's a foreign national.
Yeah.
And... he was allowed to drive without a driving license or without L plates,
yep.
And mowed down this little old lady, killed her. This little old lady, driving license to kill. Foreigners allowed on road without test pass.
There's a huge amount of that, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This country, it's ridiculous. Legal loophole tragedy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, they're the front pages. Shall we do our poll, Harry? Can you bring up a poll? We do a poll every day, don't we?
Delightful.
Let's have a look. What does it say? We asked you guys, just shy of 1,500 votes, do you think Russia plans to go to war with Great Britain? A stonking win for the no vote. 80% of you say no. 10% of you say yes. And 11% of your gut says maybe.
Mm.
So that is a stonking win, 80%. Yeah,
I don't think so.
I don't buy it that Putin's sitting in the Kremlin with his generals.
Yeah.
How are we going to attack and invade Great Britain? I don't think so. I don't believe it.
They're definitely playing games, but...
Oh, yeah. They've always done that.
Yeah.
Nothing's changed in that sense.
Mm.
Like during the Cold War, flying their fast jets right up to our airspace.
Yeah.
Just saying, like, not constant, but very, very, very common.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
This idea that a Russian sent a sub to look at our undersea cables, like... Mm. So that's par for the course.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do that.
And again, it's just being bullshit, isn't it? Showing us that they can do what they want, which is not a great position for us to be in.
Yeah. Okay. Should we do a quick little look on this day in history? People like this.
Mm.
People seem to like this. So on the 10th of April, down through the centuries, what happened of note? The first one there, I read these this morning before I come on here. The first one I don't actually know anything about. I think I've done knocking 70 episodes of The Bow Show.
Yeah.
And I think only twice did this come up with something that I didn't really know about. But this is one of them.
Mm.
It's something to do with the early 15th century China. I don't know about it, I'm afraid, so I can't speak about it. Right. The next thing, though, is very interesting. In 1815, Mount Tambora in the Dutch East Indies, which is modern-day Indonesia,
yeah.
Erupted. And it's the biggest eruption in recorded history.
Blimey.
Not in, like, geological history, but in recorded history. And it was so massive, it threw up into the atmosphere something in the order of 150 cubic kilometers of material.
Bloody hell.
To the point where there was so much material in the atmosphere of the whole world that it blocked out sunlight enough that in the following year, 1816, there was no summer in the whole world, in Europe, in the United States. The summer, the next summer of 1816, loads and loads of crops failed in New England, in Britain, in France, in the Low Countries, and there was food riots and famines because all the crops failed, because that one volcano, Mount Tambora, erupted. Imagine if something like that happened to this day, how the climate activists would go berserk.
I was just thinking that.
If something like that happened today. But yeah, it's sort of famous, the year when there was no summer. I mean, even like, Red Shelley Percy wrote about it and stuff. It was like, and Europe was recovering from the Napoleonic Wars. And so anyway, I think that's just an interesting thing that happened in history. So I know all about that one.
Or God likes to remind us that it's there, always under the surface.
It killed 71,000 of the people living near it.
Crikey.
Anywhere near it. So a gigantic, barely imaginable sort of volcanic eruption. Yeah. Okay, on this day in 1858, Big Ben is sort of recast. So that's interesting, that the actual bell in St. Stephen's Tower, Big Ben. On this day in 1972, the US, the USSR, the Soviets, and 70 other nations agreed to ban biological weapons. Which is good. That would be under Nixon, wouldn't it? That would be under Nixon. Which is, that's nice to see.
Yeah.
When they came back from the brink, like the SALT talks, trying to, let's not have insane stockpiles of nuclear weapons. Let's not keep researching biological and even nerve agents. That's probably not a good idea.
Yep.
But the Brits are at the forefront of nerve agents in various ways, like VX gas.
It's a nice thing to be involved in.
Yeah, at Porton Down and stuff. We created a nerve agent so toxic that the whole world went, even during the height of the Cold War, was like, oh, let's not do this.
Yeah.
Guys, what are we doing? It's like when they keep wanting to design bigger and bigger nukes, like tritium bombs or just a doomsday device. You build a nuke that's so big, it would destroy the Earth.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, we've designed it. We're pretty sure we can engineer one. Let's not.
Yeah.
Okay. And on this day, in 1998, the Good Friday Agreement, the Belfast Agreement, for Northern Ireland is signed by the British and Irish governments. That's obviously under Tony Blair, isn't it?
Indeed.
Get the Queen to shake Martin McGuinness's hand and all that stuff. So it was probably for the best, wasn't it? It's probably for the best, ultimately, just about. Well, no, definitely. All right, so let's do the Rumble Rants and Super Chats. You don't mind
sticking with
us for that? Okay, do the Rumble Rants first. Global Church History, in at number one, and still the reigning defending. He's always in number one. Mm-hmm. He says, on this day in 238 AD, Thrax defeated Gordian I and Gordian II, at Carthage. Yeah, so Thrax was one of those great military Roman emperors. He was meant to be a giant, if I remember my history correctly. Thrax was supposed to be like 8 foot tall, 9 foot tall. He obviously wasn't.
No.
He was just a massive bloke, and he was a military general, and he was one of the great late Christ of the 3rd century sort of military one. He also, Global Church History also says that on this day in 428 AD, Nestorius becomes the ecumenical patriarch, one of the pivotal ones in the very late Western Roman Empire.
Yep.
And on this day in 837, Halley's Comet came closest to the Earth at merely 3.2 million miles. Yeah, Halley's Comet is even depicted in the Bayeux Tapestry, isn't it?
Is it? Oh, yes, I remember.
So intermittently, every 70 odd years, you get to see it.
Yeah.
And
it's funny that, actually.
And that's been happening for millennia.
Yeah.
So
funny when you're talking about that volcanic eruption. But I do sometimes think, like, you know, we busy ourselves with politics and, you know, geopolitics and war and all this sort of thing. It's like a comet, a meteor could just come and just destroy everything.
Yeah.
And then it would all be for naught.
Statistically,
yeah,
it will.
Yeah.
Statistically, at some point, probably, there will be a mass extinction event on Earth from a meteor or an asteroid or something or a comet hitting the Earth. Yep. If we haven't got the ability to sort of blow it out of space before it hits us or something. Okay, yeah, it probably will. Well, it will happen at some point, probably. Okay, Fortean Barber says, morning, Bo and Charlie, another brilliant guest. This format is really good. One guest as an interview and one in the studio. Did you see Trump lash out at Tucker & Co.? Not sure what to make of that. I haven't seen that. When was that?
Yeah, I was going to mention
when
it earlier. So he did a Truth Social post followed by a video basically naming, I think it was Candace Owens, Tucker Carlson, and Alex Jones, basically saying that these people are a low IQ, the reason that they've been against me for so many years is because they're stupid and all this sort of thing, despite the fact that these were the people that won Trump the election on, I think, both times he won, really. I mean, these were like the core of MAGA, basically. Certainly Tucker Carlson and Alex Jones. Mm. Yeah, so he's basically turned on them and is now attacking them by name, and they put out this video of, like, it was like a sort of like boomer slot video, like an AI thing of them all shouting at the camera and Trump just sort of standing there type thing. Very silly, very childish, really. I mean, like, these are the people that should be your closest allies. Instead, you've got Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff whispering in your ear. And it's like, it's so disappointing what's happened to MAGA. I mean, do you think it's dead? Do you think, because a lot of people are saying that.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think MAGA as sort of a concept and entity, or even just as a... just as a slogan, won't outlive Trump himself. Mm. Whoever's next, whether it's Rubio or Vance, well, it's probably likely to be one of those two, isn't it? Yep. Whether they will keep talking about MAGA.
I kind of doubt it.
The actual policies is something different. Whether they'll continue with very similar, if not identical, policies, that's something different. But just the moniker, the saying of MAGA, wearing a MAGA cap.
Yes.
I feel like that will come to an end when Trump's out of office.
I agree.
Okay, Fallen Firebird says, if we had a proper country, Russia's let's take the piss incursions would be met with a missile barrage, a commando squad, and a public trial. The spikier you are, the less enemies will mess with you. I mean, at first blush, that's a fair thing to say, but I think in reality, if you look at the Cold War, they're taking the piss incursions were just, as I say, quite common. Mm. And it's just part of their strategy. It's just part of what they do.
Yeah.
And if he reacted with a missile barrage every single time, that's sort of... I get the point and I get the sentiment behind it, Fallen Firebird. I understand you, but in reality, you can't really...
Have a situation where relations were such that they just have no reason to do this stuff.
Exactly.
That's the best. That's the best scenario.
Have a relationship like we do with Sweden, where they wouldn't dream of doing something like that. Why would they?
Yeah.
There's literally no point to it. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Fictatious says, the reason why the young can't afford a house is to do with government policies, not the rich.
Of course.
Yeah.
But the reason that there's massive wealth inequality is also because of government policies. Yeah. And like that, look, people think that that's like a communist or Marxist talking point, and obviously it's a talking point that's owned by the left, like wealth inequality and that sort of thing. But like, it is a real thing. The idea of like eliminating wealth inequality completely, i.e. communism, is obviously stupid. But the idea that it, like the other idea that it doesn't matter at all, is also stupid, right? Especially when it's a conspicuous thing that people can see and feel in their own day-to-day lives, which I think certainly a lot of young people, renters, can. You know?
Yeah, the idea of blaming the rich, that the problem is billionaires, and then millionaires, and then the middle class. That's just pure commie nonsense.
It's all about incentives. Like, and this goes from like the lowest level, which is to say, you know, illegal migrants crossing the channel, they're following incentives, right? They are only coming here because of government policy, because the government is facilitating it by their own policies. And equally at the very top level, when it comes to billionaires and corporations like Amazon, you know, not paying what many people would view as their fair share in taxes, equally, that's just people following incentives. It's people following incentives created by the state. And this is the point, we have to create good incentives. Incentives that don't reward greed and indolence, which is the situation we have now. Like, if you don't work, you'll be rewarded. And if you work in such a way that screws other people, you will be rewarded. But if you're prudent and you save and you do work that benefits your community, you will be punished. You'll be taxed into the ground. You'll be regulated out of existence. You know, it's so difficult for small businesses to thrive in this country because of the amount of red tape they have to deal with. Which is to say nothing of farmers, for example. And the fact that this crucial industry, you know, a strategic sector, is under so much pressure by the government that many farms are just closing, and we're having to import more and more food, which, as we talked about earlier in the show, is a huge problem when the world is as volatile as it is today. So these are all, it's all about incentives. So if you had a state that created good incentives, that incentivized good behavior, that didn't allow people to screw each other over in business and illegal migrants to come to your country and be rewarded for doing so, then you'd be fine. So yeah, the idea of like, again, the idea of just blaming the rich, whatever that even means, it's kind, in my view, it's kind of like blaming, well, maybe not. Look, I was going to say it's kind of like blaming individual migrants for the kind of demographic situation of the UK. And there is, I mean, there's an argument to be made of the fact, like, the ones who commit crimes and who have come here, obviously they've done so of their own volition, right? So there is a, there's an argument to be made there. But again, if you ever take your focus off the elites, if you ever take your focus off the state, then you are basically, you know, you're targeting the wrong thing, because it all ultimately comes down to that.
Yeah, like the incentives to create a business, while our high streets are just mostly boarded up.
Yeah.
Or just normal shops replaced with organised crime fronts for money laundering, yeah, and drugs and people trafficking.
And nobody does anything about it.
Yeah. And why our restore policy is to remove incentives for people to come here.
Yeah. And to knock over those businesses.
And in fact to give them incentives to go back home, if anything.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Can you bring up the, Harry, can you bring up the YouTube super chats for me, please? All right, there's a fair few here, so I'll try and whip through them a bit. We've got Stedman Wheelers. Okay, says, "Hail Contentious Chadicus, Contenticus, Contenticus, Chadicus, thinker of wrongs, in rich injector of the most guilty of the higher crime of noticing." Another greeting from Texas. Hi, cool. "Enjoy your morning, and I envelope myself in sleep." Okay.
Very nice.
Good. All right. Thanks for the super chat. Taradale says, "The warmongering would be deliberate." And then you've put something that I don't understand.
Some characters.
Yeah. But okay. Yeah. Well, the warmongering is deliberate, isn't it? Of course. Yeah. I don't even know particularly what war you're referring to, and yet you're correct.
Yeah.
Right?
It's Russia or Iran or Israel.
Or Ukraine or anything. Yeah. All right. Principal Dunserty said, "You might argue if there was a weapons parity across the Middle East, then peace would finally break out." That's an interesting broad point. It's impossible to say if that... It's a very good point, actually, but it's impossible to really say, isn't it? It's one of those things. You may well be right. I'm not saying that's silly and wrong. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
But who really knows?
Yeah. I mean, again, as I said earlier in the show, like, I do believe that as much as I dislike nuclear proliferation, Britain needs to have a sovereign, independent nuclear deterrent. Like, it's just because of the world we live in. So, you know, if everyone in the Middle East had that, had one, you know, strong fences make good neighbours and all the rest of it, who knows?
Each of the seven Emirates and Qatar and Bahrain and Kuwait and Iraq and Saudi and Oman and Yemen, they all had nukes.
Yeah, that wouldn't be
great.
Then
everything would be safe.
Yeah, I
don't think so. Actually, it's interesting you talked about. I'm fascinated. I'm going to do an epoch at some point about the British bomb.
Yeah.
How after World War II, Britain and France, but in Britain's case, Clement Attlee, of all people, insisted we have our own completely independent nuclear programme. Start designing and building our own bomb, which he did. The Americans hated it and tried everything they could to scupper it.
Yeah.
But we did it in secret. When Churchill got back in the early 50s, Churchill became Prime Minister again in the early 50s, he didn't even know anything about it. And when he got into number 10 and the military chiefs are like, "By the way, Attlee's got a nuclear program." He's like, "Brilliant, I wanted to do that.
Yeah.
Wow, okay." And then it's so ruinously expensive, though. It's insanely expensive. And eventually was like, America was like, because America hated the fact that we were doing this, because it means we're truly independent, doesn't it? They were like, "Look, if you stop doing it, you can't afford it anyway, guys. If you stop doing it, we'll sell you Trident."
Yeah.
Or earlier versions.
Yes.
And we were like, okay, go on then.
Yeah, it's not a great
And situation. then we're here where we are today.
Yeah.
So, I mean, right now, could we afford to have an independent nuclear program of our own at this point? Probably not. I mean, it's insane.
If savings were made elsewhere.
Okay, yeah. I mean, maybe, yeah. Who knows?
Yeah.
I don't know the actual numbers
France manage
involved.
It, you know,
True.
And they have a far lower, they have a far smaller defence budget than we do.
That's true.
So
it's true. North Korea managed it on a budget. It has ruined their country, but they managed it. All right. What else have we got here? LJMV says, "Starmer loves Ukraine because of Ukraine." I'll just say it, because of Ukraine rent boys.
Yeah.
LJMV's words, not mine. When that trial comes up, I'm going to be fascinated with the details of who those guys are and what they were doing.
Why is nobody talks about that?
What is that?
Yeah.
We mention it on State of Politics from time to time. Yeah. What is that?
It's bizarre.
When that trial comes up.
Yeah. Conspiracy of silence among the entire mainstream press. Like, yeah, no, that's just normal. It's normal for three different Ukrainian men to firebomb the Prime Minister's house. Yeah. Okay. What? Yeah.
Like Mandy and George Osborne and Epstein all being on Nathaniel Rothschild's yacht.
Yeah.
Don't talk about that. Totally don't talk about that. Whatever you do, whatever you do, lie by omission about that every single day without fail.
Yeah.
What? Okay, same with the Ukrainian rent boys. If they are rent boys, who knows what they are, really. Mr. Dickie Bingo.
I'm sure it's all above board and normal.
Perfectly normal. Just having a normal one. Mr. Dickie Bingo says, I'd rather have a beer with Putin than Starmer. I would love to sit down with Xi Jinping or Putin and have a conversation with them.
Yeah.
I'm not their fans. I would love to have a conversation with them. Mm. And what do you think about this or that?
Yeah.
If this or that happened, what would you do?
Yeah.
That'd be an amazing conversation.
I'd just love to understand what a day in their life actually looks like, you know? Yeah. What time do they wake up? What are they for breakfast?
Yeah, yeah. What's your morning routine?
Yeah.
When you've got a free evening once in a blue moon, what do you do?
Yeah. It'd be fascinating.
Yeah, it would be. Chris281 says, I worked in Kazakhstan near the Russian border in the early 2000s. That's very interesting. And I noticed the UK's hatred of Russia, mostly on the BBC, back then. Putin is no saint, but it was odd to watch from the other side.
It's one of those things, you know, there's a lot of things like this, obviously, in politics and, you know, just what happens in the world, where if there, it seems as though there's one detail that's being kept from the public. And if that detail was to become known, everything would make sense. Because there's something about, as I said earlier in the show, there's something about the attitude of the British security establishment towards Russia that it seems as though there's something that the public don't know. It's just weird.
It does feel like that, yeah.
You know what I mean?
And there's a big cabal of people in the State Department, it seems, that are hell-bent on demonising Russia, not that they're actually good and aren't our strategic enemy and Putin isn't a good man, but
you have to say it every
nonetheless,
time.
But nonetheless, like, no, but it's odd. It's like there's something we don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, the next one says, this is a ripper. Mm. LJMV says, Charlie, can you get an interview between Elon and Rupert?
I mean, we speak to Elon from time to time.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a supporter of ours. He's not given, I mean, people say, oh, you're funded by Elon. Like, he's not given us any money, but he is a supporter of ours, which is obviously appreciated. I mean, he doesn't interview people, so I don't know if he would do that, but I mean,
just get them together to have a conversation. Yeah. It doesn't have to be an interview.
Yeah.
Just get them to have a conversation.
Yeah.
No one's interviewing on either side. Just get them to talk.
Yeah.
That would be it.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah.
I think everyone in Britain would love to see that.
Yeah.
One way or another.
Yeah.
That would be so cool.
Yeah.
I mean, Elon follows you, doesn't he, on it?
I've spoken to him on multiple occasions.
That would be...
Yeah.
That would be super cool.
Yeah.
I mean, if you need a mediator...
Yes, of course. I know who to call.
Okay. Chris then says, as a colder country, UK should be dominating in data centres. AC costs... should make hotter countries more expensive.
Yeah.
All right, so it's just simply colder. You put it up on the Hebrides.
Yeah.
OpenAI, the Hebrides are the place for you.
Yeah.
Okay, interesting point. Anime Chad Party. That's not getting old for me, finding that name amusing.
Is that registered with the Electoral Commission?
Yeah.
I hope it is.
Where did he come up with that? Anime, yeah. Being a Chad.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Party. Anime Chad Party. All right, okay, I find it funny. He says... hate to be a doomer, but considering how bad migration is right now, I have a feeling Restore won't win, especially if immigrants are given voting rights.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is something that we have talked about a lot. And it's, you know, you'll hear Rupert say that if we don't win by 29, we being the country, rather than just Restore Britain as a party, then it's kind of all locked in. And there's not going to be a political off-ramp to what is to come. And I mean, I go back and forth on this view. I think that, you know, if the will is there, Britain can be saved no matter how bad things get. And I think in 2029, the demographics will not be bad enough that a political victory by a patriotic party is impossible. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be hard. It's an uphill battle, already is. And we've only been going for, nearly 2 months. So look, I mean, I wouldn't black pill too hard on the demographic element of our vote, because there's a huge number of people out there who didn't vote in 2024.
Yes.
The majority, I believe, of whom are British, who, if activated, if presented with a programme that actually serves their interests, we'll vote, I think. And this is what we're finding with the branches, the constituency branches that we are rolling out at the moment. We've got hundreds already set up, people going out, knocking on doors, delivering leaflets and all the rest of it, including the Swindon branch, of course. And the reaction that we're having, I mean, I went to one in Horsham last week, which is a lovely, you know, idyllic town in Sussex. Mm-hmm. Currently a Lib Dem seat, and before that was Tory for 150 years. It's a very well-to-do place. And we had over 100 people turn out to the branch meeting there. And I asked them, I said, just out of interest, show of hands, for whom is this, you know, for how many of you is this your first political meeting? 90% of the room put their hand up. Right. So we're already tapping into a demographic that has not been served by the political establishment for a long time. Yeah. And if we continue to do that, if we continue to put forward policies that people actually like, which we're doing a lot of already, I am confident that we can do very, very well indeed in 2029. Mm.
The hitherto before now apathetic, the disenfranchised, the disenchanted.
Yeah.
Like, that's half the electorate.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah. So I agree with you that don't be too black-pilled. The demographic, as bad as it is not as bad, even in 2029, meaning that a party like Restore cannot win.
Yeah.
I don't think that's the case.
Yeah. Come 2034, that conversation may be much more salient. Right?
Yeah.
But even then, I still think that political solutions are viable.
Okay. Anime Chad Party again says, hiya Charlie, glad to see more guests on the show. Thank you for that. LJMV says, Bo, you magnificent man. Thank you very much. Charlie, need help with cleaning up the country? ? Aussies enjoy doing physical therapy.
Okay. Yeah, well, look, I mean, you're our cousins across the pond, and you know, I think Anglospheric unity is only a good thing.
On the other side of the world, Aussies.
Yeah. Well, indeed, yeah.
The pond, yeah. The whole world.
Pond.
Okay, so Thundercork says Russia should become a NATO province like Kosovo. Okay, I'm not entirely sure the angle you're getting at there, but okay, I'll just move on from that because I'm not quite sure. Okay, GMAC999 doesn't say anything. It just gives $10. Cheers. Cheers, buddy. Appreciate that. And the last one here today from Principled Uncertainty says, never before has the word arsonist been so funny. Oh, is that in
Ukrainian rent boys?
The rent boys. Ukrainian rent boy arson. Yeah. Comedy genius.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, that's the show. Charlie, thank you for coming in.
It's been a pleasure.
Hopefully
thank you
it won't
me.
Be the last time.
Certainly not.
It was a pleasure, an honour and a pleasure, as always. Really, really appreciate it. I think you're on the main Lotus Eaters podcast as well today.
Yep, double bill today. So.
Okay, we've got another guest as well, not so obvious, Mark Houghton. So that should be a good one. Tune in for that at 1 p.m. British summertime. All right, that's the show. Thanks to you guys for tuning in. The Best Among Us. The glorious band, The Chosen Few. It's just ticked 32 minutes past 9 in the a.m. on Friday, the 10th of April in the year of our Lord, 2026. Try and make the best of the day ahead if you can. Carpe diem, seize the day. It's the most valuable thing you've got is your time. All right, until tomorrow morning. Oh, well, until Monday morning, in fact. Take care.